whatever happened to right and wrong? What is behind the violence, greed, cheating, and moral erosion that we see in business, sports, and even the church? Why are good people making so many bad decisions? That's today.
Welcome to this Friday edition of Living on the Edge with Chip Ingram. Living on the Edge features the Bible teaching of Chip Ingram on this daily discipleship program. I'm Dave Drewy, and today Chip continues his series, Culture Shock. Now, just before we get started, let me encourage you to try using Chip's free message notes while you listen. Chip's notes contain his outline, scripture references, and much more. They'll help you remember what you hear and share what you're learning. Just go to livingontheedge.org, click Listen Now, and it's a quick download from there. Now let's join Chip for part one of his message, Whatever Happened to Right and Wrong?
I believe today if God would send Moses to America, remember he went to Israel? And when Moses came to Israel and they were in bondage, he said, let my people go. The bondage that I see in America, especially inside the church, if God sent Moses to America, he would say, let my people think. Let my people think. They've lost sight of how to think. They don't know right from wrong. They don't think clearly, and they don't know why. We've got a big problem. We've got a big problem inside the church and a big problem outside the church. Now, the symptoms flow out of morality. And morality is just the oughts and shoulds. Every culture, from the Code of Hammurabi to the Ten Commandments to the Persians or ancient Chinese, everyone has had a code of morality. This is what is right, and this is what is wrong. We're going to talk about a journey that's happened in about the last 60 to 80 years, beginning with the philosophers all the way down to modern culture, about how truth has changed. I want to read something that is deeply disturbing. It's a bit graphic, but what's happened is you can watch the 10 o'clock news and read an article or hear something and get so desensitized like I am that I read this article and it shook me. And it shook me just not because it's a terrible, insidious thing that occurred, but it shook me because of the response of the people that did it. Let me pick up the story. It happened in Houston. Two young girls, Elizabeth and Jennifer, had gone to a party in the suburbs. They called their moms and dads at 11:30 and said, we're on our way home. The two girls decided they would take a shortcut through the woods. And as they took the shortcut through the woods, there was a gang. It's called the Black and White Group. There was about six young men, ages 14 to 18. They had just finished an initiation rite where they were fighting and proving their machismo and who was strong. And these young girls were walking by, and as the article says, one of them yelled, let's get them. Those six men descended on those two young girls. 4 days later, their naked bodies were found in the woods. It's too graphic to give the details here, but they were raped multiple times, strangled, killed. Now you say, well, Chip, those things happen all the time. No. Wait a second. Ironically, one of those gang members was caught on television the day before with these words, human life means nothing. Human life means nothing. All six of those young men, ages 14 to 18, participated in both the rape and the murders. All of them were indicted. And upon hearing that they were going to go on trial for murder, one of these young men's response was, hey, great, we finally made it to the big time. My point of that story is not that murder occurred or rape occurred. That's happened for centuries. My point is there is no remorse. There's no thought that this is wrong or right. My point is what you're going to see is those exact words. Life is meaningless. Human life is meaningless. Came from about a 70-year journey of the transformation of truth. Beginning with German philosophers, then through Europe, across the channel to England, over to America by the early 20th century, into everyday culture. And then when existential thought came into full bloom, we have people who say, who's to say what's right? Who's to say what's wrong? Truth is completely relative. And so people indiscriminately kill other people for pleasure with no remorse. The symptom is our moral issues, and it's not just isolated. I noticed as I did my research, every 24 hours, 1,000 unwed teens become pregnant. 500 adolescents will begin using drugs. 135,000 kids will either kill someone or take a weapon to school. And 6 youths will commit suicide. That's not every week. It's not every month. This time tomorrow, another 6 of our teenagers will commit suicide. Human life is meaningless. There is no purpose. The real issue has to do with ethics and values. Now, when things begin to roll out in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, and business people found that you can't trust people anymore, the universities begin to put, you know, ethics and, you know, we have to need to have a standard of conduct and honesty and integrity. You see, life can't work without some values and ethics. But here's the dilemma. Whose ethics? Who's to say what's right and wrong? Who can say this is right and this is wrong when relative truth gets into the core and the fabric of a society where everyone says, well, that's true for you, but that's not true for me. And so as you see here, the question behind what's right and wrong is always, well, what's true? If you can't identify this is true, you cannot make up any right or wrong or code of ethics. To understand the real problem, you need to really get your arms around what's occurred historically, philosophically. And for this, I'm going to take you on a journey. About 70% will be philosophical and some thinking and some truth and some history. And about the last 25 or 30% will be, we're going to deal with the scriptures. And then the next number of weeks, we're going to apply, so what's true to the most controversial issues in our day? Like sexuality and homosexuality and abortion and the church and politics and the environment. But before we do, I put a list of 4 books that will trace this journey. The first is Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis. It was published in 1943 when the intellectuals were debating the issues of truth. He talks about the oughts and the shoulds within every soul, and he is that famous person who was an atheist, Oxford professor, who became the greatest apologist of the last century. The next book is The Closing of the American Mind. It was written in 1968. This is a very secular book, written by someone who makes absolutely no claim to Christianity. But Alan Bloom wrote this, became a bestseller, was very controversial in the day, and he writes in the introduction of his book, there's one thing a professor can be absolutely certain of. He taught at Yale, Cornell, later Chicago University. Every professor can be absolutely certain that every student entering the university believes, or says he believes, that truth is relative. The students' backgrounds are as varied as America can provide. Some are religious, some are atheists, some are to the left, some are to the right. Some intend to be scientists, some humanists. Others professionals or business people. Some are poor and some are rich. But they are unified only in their relativism and in their allegiance to equality. And the two are related in a moral intention. The relativity of truth is not a theoretical insight to them, but a moral postulate. Do you hear what he's saying? This is 1968, and he basically claims that the universities are ruining the entire next generation because they're teaching that all truth is relative, and now the students believe that. The next book is by a Berkeley law professor, Philip Johnson. It's called Reason in the Balance, The Case Against Naturalism. And he takes the issue of relative truth, applies it to law and to the sciences. He is a Christian. He debates all over the world. And finally, Francis Schaeffer, who wrote from the 60s all the way through the 90s. And Schaeffer begins to trace philosophically and in culture and in art, how did we get here? See, the question, I titled the sermon, Whatever Happened to Right and Wrong? I mean, what happened to right and wrong? How do we get to where there is no real right or there is no real wrong, or at least no one can agree on a few basic things I mean, historically, I'm telling you, for thousands and thousands and thousands of years, up until about the last 50 or 60, everyone agreed, telling the truth, not stealing, being faithful to your partner, being kind, being respectful, not hurting other people indiscriminately, keeping your word, forgiving people who've done you wrong, not murdering. These were absolutes. And it produced, people may have disobeyed them, but when they disobeyed them, they thought what they were doing is wrong. They didn't do it with a calloused, human life has no meaning. We just killed and raped two little girls, and it doesn't matter. And who's to say it does? See, that's the logical end when there is no absolute truth. I was not a Christian most all my life growing up, totally disillusioned with the organized church, which in my particular case, not to say that others were, but in my particular case was filled with hypocrisy. No one believed God's word and no one lived it. And so I rejected it. I came to Christ at 18, and after coming to Christ, it began to grow rapidly after about 3 or 4 years. And then in grad school, I found myself with a lot of relative truth and a lot of sociology professors and psychology professors and a lot of people challenging my faith. And what I found myself was, I was in this situation where I had this amazing experience. I was experiencing God. My life was changing, but I didn't have good answers for the intellectual questions that were being thrown at me. Anybody ever go through that? And I kind of made this internal decision that I'm not going to throw my brains in the trash to follow Christ. I'm not going to be sort of led into some way that, you know, maybe it's just my emotions. And so I went on a journey. I went on a journey in terms of philosophy and other religions to dig out what is true and how could we know. I was playing on a basketball team at the time with a pre-med student named Steve Vogel. And Steve was very familiar with Francis Schaeffer. I'd never read anything by Francis Schaeffer. He has three key books. One is He Is There and He's Not Silent. The other is Escape from Reason. And then the other I put in your notes here, The God Who Is There. And Schaeffer, in those three books, that's the core of his trilogy, will trace for you and me the movement from absolute truth of all of history, how it started, how it changed, and then how it moved through the different disciplines to where it gets all the way to the point where someone kills two little girls and says life is meaningless. And what I want you to know, that didn't just happen. There's a clear shift in how people viewed truth that impacted morals, that's created the world, by the way, that you live in and your kids live in. And I just want to tell you, this whole series will not be banging the table about people are doing what's wrong and we need to do what's right and this is right and that's wrong and those are terrible people and the problems of government or the problems of Hollywood or the problems of media. That's not what this is about. This is about us saying we have a problem, we the church have a problem. We don't believe in what's true. We don't know how to think anymore. And that's why we can't understand why the average age of a teenager leaving the faith is 16 years old. There's only 4% of the teenagers today that would self-identify as a follower of Christ. 91% of teenagers don't believe in absolute truth. 66% of adults in America don't believe in absolute truth. And in the 18 to 35 year, 72 or 3 out of 4 people don't believe in absolute truth. In a recent Barna research, very, very interesting. They went on a campus, after doing all this research, went on a large university campus and went randomly to 20 people and just asked them, do you believe there is an absolute truth that's true of all people of all time that is just absolutely true? And the responses went like this. Truth is whatever you believe. There is no absolute truth. If there were such a thing, absolute truth, how could we know what it is? People who believe in absolute truth are dangerous. 19 of 20 of those people, that was their response. The 20th was an evangelical student who said, I believe absolute truth is in the person of Jesus Christ. Most of mankind's history has believed that there is truth that is absolutely true, whether I experience it or not. For example, things like if I take a book, I can say I don't believe in gravity, but if I drop the book, whether I believe in gravity or not, the book drops. To get more personal, people can say I don't believe in gravity, but if they get to a three-story building and step off, their belief system may change very quickly, or at least their experience does. We act on things that we don't see, like electricity. When we want to have brain surgery, we're really hoping the person believes in absolutes, like that might be the right tumor to take out instead of that. We believe in absolutes when we pull up to a gas station. We don't say any liquid will do. Who are you say, why don't we just put water in? It's cheaper. I mean, how narrow and intolerant to think the only thing that you can put in a combustion engine is gasoline or diesel. We live on the basis of absolutes in all these areas, except in the things like, what is life all about? What's right and wrong? Is there meaning or purpose? Why am I here? On the biggest issues of life. And so for most all of history, it's been, there's absolute truth. By contrast, you'll notice that truth is relative as the existential concept of truth. In the 60s and the 70s, as it went from the philosophers down to sort of everyday people, you heard phrases like, just do your thing. If it feels good, do it. Later, as it moved on, it was, well, truth is different for me than different from you. And then finally, the one we hear all the time, well, who are you to judge? The premise of who are you to judge is pluralism. And pluralism simply states that all opinions, all the time, have equal value. And so the number one virtue of relative truth is tolerance. Not the meaning of the word tolerance in terms of accepting people for where they are, but tolerance as in anyone who says this is right and this is wrong on any issue is intolerant. The number one virtue of absolute truth is truth and justice. And what I'd like to do is take you on a little journey and talk about how we got here. I told you I met that friend on that basketball team, and my first book by Francis Schaeffer, I wasn't a philosophy major, and so I was getting words like metaphysics and epistemology, and so I remember having a 3x5 card where I would read a paragraph, go to a dictionary, look things up. Later, that became the basis of my master's thesis at West Virginia University, because I decided I needed to dig in and find out what's true, what's not, what's happened. And so those three books, along with a lot of other information, became the heartbeat of why do I believe what I believe? Why do I believe, or do I believe, that there is an absolute truth? And what I want to do is give you a thumbnail sketch. And here's my challenge. Some of you need to pick up some of these books and read and think. We are so technically savvy to get right now information. What happens, we're living inside of a bubble. And you're living inside of a bubble about what's practical and what can you get and what about this and what about that. But you don't stop to ask the big issues of life. Sometimes you need to read some books that are hard to read, that are thoughtful, that are deep. And then you need to take those concepts, especially if you're a parent, and sit around the table and talk about not just what's right and what's wrong and be a good person, but why do you think the way you think and what's the basis for it? Wisdom, according to the scripture, is built on knowledge and understanding. Knowledge is about the what. Understanding is about the why. So bear with me, but let me give you a little journey on what happened. How did our view change so dramatically? For the first 1,200 years of the church, truth was defined by revelation. In other words, God has spoken. He's spoken through his word, Old Testament, New Testament. But most people didn't have a Bible. There wasn't a printing press. The only people that had the truth were, quote, the clergy. Well, after 1,200 years, actually after about 500 or so, we saw that what the church was saying and what the Bible actually taught, there was corruption, just like there's corruption in the church today. And so little by little by little, the church began to teach things that the Bible would say this, but the church would say this, and you have the period that's called the Dark or Middle Ages. People didn't know much. A lot of things were said in the name of God that were contrary to God, contrary to his will. And religion got used and mixed up with the state. Then we saw the big breakthrough, and the big breakthrough happened in the 13 to about the 1500s called the Renaissance. And the Renaissance, in essence, the word means rebirth. And a rebirth happened in two streams. The one stream in the secular world was a going back to the classics, to Greek literature, to Plato, to the art, to David, to statutes. And pretty soon, instead of man being this worm and this person that has no value or nobility, the Renaissance was the birth of humanism. It's that man has value and nobility, and given enough time and energy, we can change the world and make the world what it is. And so the classics and art was changed. The other stream was among Christians, and there was a return to historic Christianity, to the original texts. And so people like Martin Luther began to actually study the Bible for themselves in the original autographs, the Hebrew and the Greek, the Latin Vulgate, and they began to do things and said, realize, you know what, the church is saying this, but the book of Galatians and the book of Romans says this, and that gave birth to the Reformation. It was a calling back to truth, a calling back to what does God say? And so the Reformation occurred, and you had Zwingli and Luther and Calvin and Melanchthon, and this return to truth and this return to what does the Bible say and the authority of Scripture, and you had a revolution occur. Overlapping that was then the Enlightenment in the 1600s to 1700s. It was called the Age of Reason. Rousseau would say that man is basically good. But what we need is we've had all these difficult, painful things that have happened in history, but man is basically good. With enough time, with enough education, we can produce a utopia. Immanuel Kant would follow up that, and you had what was called the rationalist, and people that thought reason instead of revelation. Now, it's man's thinking. Man is the center. Man is the measure. And we and our thinking and our reasoning is the authority. What we think is different than what God says, reason champions. And so you had this birth of the Enlightenment. After the Enlightenment, again, crossing over was the Industrial Revolution of the 1700s, 1800s. More inventions in that period of time happened than probably the last 2,000 years. Amazing inventions. Inventions that began to change the world, and prosperity occurred, and industry occurred, and things were just multiplying. And so now man is the center, reason is the authority, and the self-sufficiency of we can actually change the world. We'll make the world what we want it to be. In the midst of that, in the 1700s and 1800s, Charles Darwin wrote a book. Did you know he was a theology student? 1859, he wrote a book called Origin of the Species. Now what you need to understand is that it had little or no scientific impact. No one bought into it whatsoever. But at the end of the 19th century, it became a buzzword, evolution. And it was the soft or the social sciences that picked up on evolution as a way of thinking and relationships. And it began to become how people begin to think. Not that there was scientific credibility behind it. At the same time, another young man, the theory of relativity would be birthed by Albert Einstein. Einstein never thought truth was relative. What he was talking about was a new way of looking at the world, a new paradigm, instead of through just one reference point. He said, no. You can look at reality through more than one reference point. But the buzzword in the early 20th century was about this idea of relativity. Now, the philosophers then got a hold of this. German philosophers first, and then those German philosophers began to extend through Europe, and then from Europe across the channel, and as I said, then to America. And so that gave birth to what's called the age of modernity, or modern thought, 1890 to about 1930. You had people in ways like never before saying, you know what, truth isn't absolute, it's relative. And so as they came through all these seasons in history, a group like Jasper, later it would be Kierkegaard, a Danish, and then later across the channel and in France, Jean-Paul Sartre. And pretty soon, Nietzsche and the God is Dead movement. And all this was like way out there, kind of weird intellectuals. And then it came across to America. And Huxley, who was a biologist, picks this up and believes it. Spencer, who's a philosopher, picks it up. And then they begin to teach this in the universities, and it began to make its way early in the seminaries of the major denominations. Dewey then, in the early part of the 20th century, would say, you know something? The real issue isn't what's right or what's wrong. The real issue is what works, and pragmatism was birthed. And basically, the whole educational system, rather than the classics and this is true and what we know and God being the authority, it's man's the center. Our reason trumps everything. truth is something that is a matter of perspective. And then it moved because since that doesn't work, that reality doesn't work in real life. We'll look at it in a minute. Then what happened? People begin to experience despair. And so Kierkegaard would say, from a sort of a religious perspective, you need to take a leap of faith to find meaning. Jaspers would say, you need a final experience. And so pretty soon, the only way to authenticate truth is your experience, existentialism. So if it feels good, do it. This would give birth to situational ethics. And so I still remember as about a 10-year-old, my mom was a guidance counselor, and William Sloan Coffin, wrote the book, and in all of our public schools, we began to teach situational ethics. And it was taught by giving these people these impossible dilemmas, you know, what would you do if there's five people back in the room? Would you lie in order to protect them? And, you know, no sense of, yes, there are competing values. And so in all of our public schools, we began to teach there is no absolute right or wrong. There is no moral fabric. And so you get the birth of the 60s. And the 60s is a throwing off all moral constraint. And then the 70s is the age of experimentation. The 80s becomes the me generation. It's not just what works, but what works for me, and greed is paramount. And then the 90s, we have the kids of the parents of the 60s who grew up without any sense of absolutes. And so now we're surprised because the divorce rate goes from single digits to over 50%. Why? Who's to say? The question in life isn't what's right, it's not what's wrong, it's what works. In fact, it's what works for you. Do your own thing. That's true for you, but not true for me. Do you get it? Here's what you got to understand. All of what I just shared philosophically and historically is why when your kids go to trade school or college or hang out in your high schools at 16 or 17 and say, I believe in Jesus, and people start asking them questions, 1, 2, 3, and 4, that they don't have any good answers. And that's why, by the way, inside the church, the problem may be as big or as difficult. Research right now in the people in their 20s and 30s in Bible-teaching churches now would say that living together is morally acceptable. We have about a third of our teenagers who would say homosexuality or loving another person of the same sex is morally acceptable. This is in the church. And when you say things like, this is right and this is wrong, you're pegged as some sort of old-fashioned, don't you get it? They have no idea where they got that. When a guy hoists up a beer and says, life is meaningless, and kills someone indiscriminately, what he doesn't understand is that's what John Parsart said. Exactly. There is no meaning. There is no rhyme. If we're from chaos, random chance, this is just the logical flow of what's happened. And the church has got to wake up.
Chip will be right back. But if you've just joined us, you're listening to Living on the Edge with Chip Ingram. Chip's message today, Whatever Happened to Right and Wrong, is from his series, Culture Shock. In this bold series, Chip addresses fundamental yet controversial cultural issues from a winsome biblical point of view. Topics covered are human sexuality, the truth about sex, abortion, homosexuality, and the church and politics. Parents, help equip your children to know the truth about these important topics and consider using this series as a devotional study with your teens and preteens. Culture Shock is also a popular study for Sunday schools, youth groups, or neighborhood Bible studies. Chip does the teaching and brings the issues to the table in a way that promotes discussion versus debate, light versus heat. The small group study is currently discounted. So take advantage of this opportunity and order your study today. Just give us a call at 1-888-333-6003 or visit us online at livingontheedge.org. Well, Chip, before we come back with some final thoughts from today's talk, I know here at Living on the Edge that we're strong advocates for doing life together in small groups. But when it comes to this series and the highly controversial topics covered in it, I imagine that there are a lot of people who are pretty hesitant to lead a group like this. What can we do to help them be more confident?
Well, that is an insightful question, and you're right. I've actually had people tell me, yay, you really want me to lead a group that talks about politics, abortion, homosexuality? I mean, are you on drugs? And to which I say, you know, not officially, but yes, I want you to do that. And here's why. your children, if you did nothing than lead a group for your family and a handful of close friends, let alone, you know, in your church or in the marketplace, people are making decisions and having their values shaped by television, by movies, by political rhetoric right now, and they're going to get their information from somewhere. And Jesus was very clear that you have to know the truth and apply the truth, and then you're set free. And so, yes, it might be uncomfortable. You might even be perceived a little negatively at times, but someone has to step up. I mean, think of all those passages where Jesus talked about, you know, blessed are you that are persecuted, or blessed are you when you step up and you step out for my sake. And so, you know, what I want you to know is it's okay to be afraid, but we need to teach in the church, especially to our young people and our young adults, what the Bible says about these very controversial topics, and they need to hear it with warmth and compassion and with research where, you know, it's not just this is what we believe and you're angry, or there's this passive silence that is literally killing the church. And so, yes, we will give you some tools to help you lead. We've talked a lot about our online course for small group leaders, but I think the issue here is courage. Would you just be willing to lead this, and then just trust God with the results? He's going to come through.
Thanks, Chip. For complete information on all the Culture Shock resources, including the book and previews of the small group video sessions, visit us online at livingontheedge.org. Or if you'd prefer to talk with someone about these resources, you can always reach us by calling 1-888-333-6003. And for a limited time, the small group study of Culture Shock is significantly discounted. To get your copy today, visit us online at livingontheedge.org or give us a call at 1-888-333-6003. Now, with some final thoughts, here's Chip.
As we close today's program, I just want you to lean back right where you are, no matter what you're doing. And I just want you to think with me for just a minute. I mean, I shared some shocking stories. I mean, if they're not shocking to you, then you've become desensitized like I find myself getting desensitized. I mean, every night on the news, there is just story after story that would just curl our hair 30 years ago. It's stories of people who live lives in ways that we would say to ourselves, how can this happen? And what I want you to understand is it's not about pounding the table and saying, you know, things are really terrible and calling into talk radio shows and having coffee with fellow Christians and whining and complaining about this is terrible. You need to understand that we are reaping what we've sown. And what we've sown is a lack of commitment to absolute truth. And it has infiltrated the church. And some of the biggest issues in the church, not out there, in the church, are in terms of sexual fidelity, purity, honesty. We'll learn a little bit later in the series that about 1/3 of all teenagers today believe that same-sex relationships are morally acceptable to God. We're going to learn that among the 18 to 30-year-olds, I mean the young professionals, the young people in our church, that about 60% of them believe living together is morally acceptable before God. And this is not going to be a series of hitting people over the head to try and make them feel guilty. The fact of the matter is the chaos and the pain and the breakup and the divorce and what's happening to kids and the results of this lack of truth is killing the church and it's killing God's people. This series is about getting to the root of how we got here, and then real solutions from God's Word about how we can make a difference. So it's very heavy at times. There's lots of information. Let me encourage you to go to livingontheedge.org. The message notes, the diagrams, the things that I share, they're all available online, and they're there for free.
Thanks, Chip. Well, we're wrapping it up here, but I know there was one more thing you wanted to say.
We've talked today and in the last few days about the most important things that are going to impact the culture, your family, your kids. And I just want to say thank you to a very special group of people that have been very generous and gave us the money to create these small group DVD resources. you are enjoying the fruit and tools of people that have been extraordinarily generous so that Christians could live like Christians and make a difference in America. And I just want to pause to say thank you. Thank you very much to each person who's been on the team. And maybe just close by saying, if you'd like to join the team, we could certainly use your help and would appreciate it deeply.
If you've been blessed by the ministry of Living on the Edge, it's easy to send a gift to Living on the Edge. Simply visit us online at livingontheedge.org. Or you can always reach us at 1-888-333-6003. And let me say thanks for your generous support of this ministry. We'll be sure to join us again on Monday as Chip continues our current series, Culture Shock. Until then, this is Dave Drewy saying thanks for listening to this edition of Living on the Edge.